Oh, hey there, folks. It's me, Andrew Pierce. You might have noticed that the Awards Don't Matter podcast feed is now merged with the Curb podcast feed. And you've suddenly, if you've subscribed to Awards Don't Matter, suddenly seen that there is a whole wealth of interviews and things that you have no idea about appear in your podcast feed. This is nothing to be alarmed by, as the show will now be hosted on the main podcast feed alongside those interviews that I do for The Curb. As you may have noticed as well, the Awards Don't Matter has been a little dormant, with it being almost 2 years since the last episode was released, which is shame on us and shame on me too, as it's taken nearly that length of time to edit the one episode we have in the can, discussion on William Wyler's The Best Years of Our Lives. I'll play the trailer in a moment, but you'll note in the intro that Dave and I talk about what we've been doing with our lives. Well, Dave got engaged and I was busy working on a book. And that book, the Australian Film Book, Volume 1, is now out in the world. And I'm busy working on a second book creatively titled The Australian Film Book, Volume 2. Dave, on the other hand, is now happily married and, as far as I can tell, not working on another marriage, which is wonderful. Anyhow, we aim to bring you more episodes of Awards Don't Matter in the future. I'll corral Dave into recording an episode on It's a Wonderful Life 2. Not It's a Wonder Life 2, but It's a Wonderful Life also. I don't know if there'll ever be a sequel to It's a Wonderful Life. Maybe in our AI future, we will never know. For now, here's our chat about the best years of our life.
These are the great personalities who bring a memorable experience to glowing life. Samuel Goldwyn's masterpiece. The screenplay was written by Robert E. Sherwood, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Petrified Forest and Idiot's Delight. From this, William Wyler, who won the Academy Award for his direction of Mrs. Miniver, wove a pattern of motion picture magic. With Myrna Loy and Frederick March living through the heartwarming second bloom of love. Dana Andrews and Teresa Wright feeling the breathtaking thrill of love at first sight. Hoagy Carmichael spreading his own brand of stardust. All of them together giving all of us the best years of our lives.
I know. I see the ears pop up. Everyone's like, hey, motherfucker, what's up?
Yeah. What are you doing? All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome. This us again. It's us again. Awards Don't Matter. The people who do awards don't matter. Hello.
We're back.
We're back.
We exist. We are real. We're back on your feed.
Yeah. Who knows for how long? Might be a long time. Might be a short time. Who knows?
That's right.
Time is meaningless. What have you been doing in the meantime since we last recorded, Dave?
Oh, you know, nothing really. Just got engaged to be married, you know, little things like that. Yeah, it's been exciting. You've been very busy. I've been very busy. So fuck the listeners, basically. Like, we've both been really busy living life, but you couldn't keep us away for quite long enough. We are sadly back to talk about Oscars.
Exactly. So Dave's gotten engaged. I've been writing a book. You can find more about that later on in the future. But yeah, so that's why we haven't been around, because we've been busy with life and living and Christmas and all this kind of stuff. And we had a perfect film to discuss for Christmas, which will be a future episode. But on this episode, what are we talking about?
We're talking about an Oscar winner, not some loser movie. The Best Years of Our Lives. I guess it's also known as Glory for Me or Home Again. I didn't realize it had three different titles, but that's according to the Wikipedia. But yeah, The Best Years of Our Lives, directed by William Wyler. That's what we're talking about today. More war, Andrew. We are back to talk about more violence. Like, Jesus. The Oscars, man, they love their war pictures.
They sure do. There's no violence on screen here, though. Unlike William Wyler's previous Best Picture and Best Director winner, Mrs. Miniver.
Ugh, God.
And unlike his next and final Best Picture winner, which is Ben-Hur, which is as violent as they come for the time.
That's true.
But this one, yeah, he wins Best Picture, it wins Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Editing, Adapted Screenplay, and Original Score, and stars the wonderful Teresa Wright.
I knew you were going to bring her up.
It's
all that matters. She's the only person in this film. There are other people, but she's the only person that matters. But this is a really wonderful story about post-World War II and three veterans who are returning to their hometown of Boone City in somewhere America, Midwest America. And one is from the Navy, one's a pilot, and the other one's a sergeant. And so we get all tiers of the soldier perspective. And it's about their life as they come home. Now, are you as cynical as me and looked at the runtime for this and went, oh, this is going to be another, like, fucking Mrs. Miniver turgid film?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's like darn near 3 hours, right?
Yeah,
like
172 minutes.
Yeah, it's a long movie. And it did make me think as I was watching it, and you do understand pretty quickly why it's such a long movie. You're essentially telling three intersecting stories throughout this movie. And like if you focused solely on one character, you'd have like a normal length of movie. So you start to get it. And Andrew, I got to tell you, I was ready to come on here before I watched the movie. Like I was going to be like, F this, F that, this movie sucks. Look at, you know, the other movies that were nominated. My God, this nonsense. But it's really good. It's a really good movie.
Like, you can call it great. It's okay to call it great because it is great.
I will not. I don't know if it's. I think we use words like that too easily. Or I do at least. I find that I slip into this was amazing. This was great. And there's nothing wrong with being very good. This is a very good movie. Will I ever watch it again? Absolutely not. I'm not ever going to spend another 3 hours watching this. But I'm glad I watched it. And the performances are really what carries it. I think all three lead male characters are wonderful in this in very different ways. I like the fact that not only do we have like kind of three different areas of the military and jobs in the military, but different points of life, right? Mm. For all of these men, when it comes to their families, when it comes to their careers and their lives, and you can see how they intersect and the different challenges each one of them faces. And God, it's really, really good, Andrew. Like I am shocked by how much I enjoyed this movie.
It is so well performed and so comfortably, you know, before we were recording, we were talking about Drive My Car and how that is a 3 hour long film that just fits its runtime perfectly because it takes its time. It is a very patient film in getting to the point that it needs to get to. And with Best Years of Our Lives, I didn't realize until it was actually happening that some of these scenes last for 10, 15 minutes. And, you know, that used to happen quite a bit. There used to be films that took their time with basic setup scenes. Like there is a sequence where Friedrich March's Sergeant Al is waking up after a hangover. And there is a sequence that goes for maybe about 5 minutes of him just getting up and dealing with the morning. And that includes throwing his shoes out the window and just trying to recognize, I am very hungover. Where am I? Oh, I'm back at home, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the film goes to great lengths of making sure that we are on this journey with them. And because of that, the brevity of the time that we have with them, which is 3 hours, it's a short time really in, you know, the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of that over a couple of days. Like, this is not a long, you know, long journey. Right. This is only a couple of days with them. And we make sure that we get to spend pivotal moments with them and getting to understand what it's like immersing themselves back into day-to-day life. And that's no more important than Harold Russell's award-winning turn here. He is, you know, quite a brilliant performance here as Homer. And it's a
so good.
Important win, of course, because Harold is disabled. He does not have his forearms. There are, you know, he lost them during the war. And so it is an informed performance. But his narrative is really important because he's afraid of how people see him. And there's so much going on here. Yeah.
Yeah. As I was watching that performance in particular, I was stunned that this performance was in this time period. Like, it feels so forward-thinking, right? The way it deals with it. Not just his performance, but the way it's written. That he's never, even though he has a disability, you never see him as less than.
Yeah.
Right? You never see him. You see him as a hero. You see someone who's struggling. You see him making his way through life, and like these small, seemingly small adjustments that have to be made, like the type of glass that he can pick up versus that he can't. You know, things we as, you know, more able-bodied folk like don't ever think about.
Mm.
Right. And it's like, and it does a really good job of both showing those difficulties, but also building him up and building up his character. Like there is just a beautiful sequence later in the movie, because the whole movie is kind of pushing this girl away who was, you know, before he left, this was his sweetheart and they were going to get married and it's going to be great. And he pushes her away because he can't bring himself to like put his arm around her, which is a implement at this point. And then she keeps telling him, like, I'm here. I'm not going away. Like, I love you. I don't care. Let me help. Let me be there for you. And the scene where he walks her through everything that he has to do to go to bed is heart-wrenching.
This is when I know I'm helpless. My hands are down there on the bed. I can't put them on again without calling to somebody for help. I can't smoke a cigarette or read a book. That door should blow shut. I can't open it and get out of this room. I'm as dependent as a baby that doesn't know how to get anything except cry for it. Well, now you know, Wilma. Now you have an idea of what it is. I guess you don't know what to say. It's all right. Go on home. Go away like your family said.
I know what to say, Homer. I love you, and I'm never going to leave you. Never.
You mean you didn't mind?
Of course not. I told you I loved you.
I love you, Wilma. I always have, and I always will.
And the vulnerability that he shows as well.
Yeah, it's like I was looking for that word exactly. Like he's being so vulnerable in front of her. And you, especially during this time in American history, in film history, you don't really see that vulnerability from men unless it's in a mocking way. And there is not, I don't know if you saw anything, but I didn't see a single frame in this movie that mocked Homer ever. Even when he struggles and when he screws up and when he breaks things because he can't hold on to things, like you're never meant to laugh at him. You're meant to engage with him and not even pity him. Like, I don't think it's even a pitying performance. It's just a like, wow, this is really hard. And I hope Homer makes it through. Because that scene where he like smashes the window in frustration, you know, come see the monster. Like it's brutal. Like, and it's such a good performance. Like, I think my only negative in this movie is like the female characters are extremes, right?
Yeah.
They're either like the perfect woman or the like the loose woman at the nightclub. Like those are the only two options. You can't have somebody, I guess, like the one of our lead characters' daughter who falls in love with another one of our lead characters. Like she's the only one who's kind of in between because she is like there is a point where she's like, yeah, I'm going to break up this marriage.
Yeah, that's and right. She says it that's so brilliantly exactly as well.
Yeah, it's a great little moment. And I like the interactions between her and her parents. And I also like that, like, all three of these men have their difficulties, right? Homer's is the most obvious. It's on the surface. You can literally see he does not have his forearms. It's pretty obvious. But then you have, you know, our older character who goes back into banking, and he clearly has a drinking problem. And like it's interesting because in the beginning of the film, it's like kind of a joke and kind of fun, like, you know, very Nick and Nora type drinking. And then as the movie goes on, you're like, oh, this is kind of a serious issue. this is problematic. And then your third character, you know, essentially has PTSD.
Yeah.
He has these night terrors where he's screaming out for men who have died because he went on all these bombing missions. So it's like they all have their own struggles, but none of them are so ridiculous and over the top that you get distanced from it. Like, you feel for all three of these men in different ways, but you feel for all of them and you want them to be happy. And it's especially painful and difficult when two of the men are at odds.
Exactly.
Because you have the father and then the, you know, the daughter's in love with this other guy. And there's that scene in the, you know, in the booth where he's just like, just tells him straight, like, you gotta go away.
Yeah, you're a married man. You can't do this. Yeah.
Oh. And it's so hurtful because you want the best for him. And they make it very clear from the beginning that this woman who he is married to is not great. Not someone you want your lead character with. Kind of money grubbing, kind of party lifestyle. And it's very clear that you're not supposed to like her, which, again, is my only complaint of the movie, is the women at home are very extreme in either direction.
But the film does a good job of never making you anticipate that Peggy and Fred, I think it is, the ones who are actually going to end up next to each other. They, you know, you don't actually believe that it is a foregone conclusion, because the film does suggest that he will just walk away and do the right thing and be with his wife and live that life until, you know, his hand is forced and she divorces him because, you know, the inevitability there. And that scene is a little bit trite for sure, because it feels like a, we need to get this plot moving kind of thing. We've got, you know.
But even after they split and he runs off, like, I don't think even then it's a foregone conclusion that these two characters are going to end up together. Like, you're like, I don't know, maybe they just go their own separate ways, you know? And then, of course, you have this wedding at the end to bring everyone together, which is really nice and, you know, Hollywood-y, but sweet, and it works. And I like that they don't immediately just fall back into each other's arms. There's a beautifully shot sequence where he is just staring at her throughout the wedding and taking her in. And, like, it's very rare you can see, like, love in a look on screen. And that is due to his performance, her performance, but also the angle and the shot that is used there, where you see kind of, you see the party going on in soft focus.
Yeah.
It's very like West Side Story in that way, right? Where, like, all these other things are going on, but the only thing I can see clearly is her. And it's a beautiful shot. It's just like, oh, God, these two, they have to be together.
Well, that's the thing, is this is a film that is full of beautiful shots. And oddly, it wasn't nominated for any of the cinematography, and that's fine. But the key thing that is very interesting is that throughout the film, there are these beautifully split shots. And they do kind of mostly focus on Fred as a character. And, of course, there's that wedding shot, which is almost like, it feels very De Palma-esque because they're both in focus. Mm-hmm. The wedding's in focus and he's in focus far away. But then early on in the film, there is a moment when, as you were saying, that moment where Al and Fred are talking and Al basically says, you can't be with my daughter at all. And there is this beautifully in shot, framed focus shot of Fred on the phone having a conversation far in the back of this frame while everything else, the action is happening. And then, of course, Homer is then showing Al how he plays the piano and stuff, all the while Fred's still on the phone. And then at a later stage as well, there is this beautiful moment where Fred stands up for Homer in the bar with this conspiracy theorist kind of guy. And it's another moment that reinforces the power of their bond and their friendship, which is just reinforced from the very first moment that they meet each other, because they don't know each other prior to hopping on a plane back home. Nope. And they immediately become friends.
Hello, Homer.
Hi, Fred.
How have you been? Glad to see you.
Say, Fred.
Yeah?
What happened at Butch's?
What do you mean?
I mean, you and Al. Was there any trouble?
Oh, no, we were just having a little friendly chat. There you are, sir. Thanks. What'll yours be, Homer?
Oh, I don't care. Give me a chocolate sundae.
Okay.
Hi.
How are you, soldier?
Sailor.
Huh. Excuse me. Say, you mind if I ask a personal question?
I know what it is. How did I get these hooks and how do they work? That's what everybody says when they start off. Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? Well, I'll tell you, I got sick and tired of that old pair of hands I had. You know, an awful lot of trouble washing them and manicuring my nails. So I trade them in for a pair of these latest models. They work by radar. Look. Pretty cute, eh?
You got plenty of guts. It's terrible when you see a guy like you that had to sacrifice himself. And for what?
And for what? I don't get you, mister.
Well, anything else for you?
Check. We let ourselves get sold down the river. We were pushed into war.
Sure, by the Japs and the Nazis, so we
had... No, the Germans and the Japs had nothing against us. They just wanted to fight the Limeys and the Reds. And they would have whipped them, too. We didn't get deceived into it by a bunch of radicals in Washington.
What are you talking about?
We fought the wrong people, that's all. Just read the facts, my friend. Find out for yourself why you had to lose your hands. And then go out and do something about it.
You better pay your check, brother, and go home.
Well, who do you think you are?
Pay the cashier right over there.
Coffee, please.
Yes, ma'am. And that's another thing. Every soda jerk in this country's got an idea he's somebody.
Look here, mister. What are you selling anyway?
I'm not selling anything but plain old-fashioned Americanism.
Some Americanism. So we're all a bunch of suckers, eh? So we should have been on the side of the Japs and the Nazis, eh?
Again, I say, just look at the facts.
I've seen a couple of facts. I've seen a ship go down and over 400 of my shipmates went with it. Were those guys suckers?
That's the unpleasant truth. And the sooner we get wise to it, the better off we're going to...
Oh, if I only had my hands.
You put those down!
Take your hands off of it.
Go get the druggist.
Yes, sir.
Make way safe. What happened? It was Fred Derry. He hit him.
Bring some aromatic spirits of ammonia, iodine, and bandages.
Yes, sir.
Don't say it, chum. The customer's always right, so I'm fired. But this customer wasn't right. I'll meet you outside in a minute, kid.
But he stands up for him, for Homer, in this this bar, and basically Homer's like, you know, if I had fists, I would punch your face out. And then Fred takes it as being like, all right, I will do that. And then we
I've
see,
got those.
Yeah, I've got those. And then we see the background, and we see what's going on there. And that's reflected even further back as well, when Fred is having a conversation with Peggy, and they're having a conversation about perfume and stuff. And he's like, look, you have to make out like you're actually going to buy something, because otherwise we'll get in trouble.
Man, that scene is so... There is so much sexual chemistry in that scene. But this, it's, like, palpable.
Yeah.
Like, and this is... I mean, it's one of the things I love about older movies, right? Is they couldn't go so over the top with the sexual situations and the flirtation. So it's almost like they had to work a little bit harder to get that libido on the screen. And that sequence, like the way those two look at each other, you're like, oh my God, will you get a room? Like this is my goodness. But you bring up the cinematography, which was stunning. And what was the Academy doing at this period of time? Like, maybe you know this. There's only like, basically there's best cinematography black and white and best cinematography color. And there's only like two movies in each that get nominated. Like they just like pick two. So The Yearling and Anna and the King of Siam won for color and black and white respectively. But it's like, where's the red? Everything else has like at least five nominees. It's like the cinematographers went like, ah, that one. We're going to get to that one.
That makes
we're not
no
gonna
sense.
Tell you anything else.
And keep in mind, this is the year that Brief Encounter was also out as well. David Lean was nominated for Best Director. Like, that film wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. We'd be talking about that as well if we had a chance, but it wasn't nominated for Best Picture. And that's a visually stunning film, too. You know?
And if you want to hear me talk about Brief Encounter, you can go listen to Offscreen Death, because we covered that previously. Yeah, it's a great, great movie. Like,
perfect film.
Maybe the best movie about longing I have ever seen. And that's like my catnip. Like, I love that stuff. Like, give me a movie about people who love each other, but they don't get the opportunity to be with one another. Yeah. Man, that is like, yeah, man, this is where it's at. But speaking of the Academy, like, this is an interesting year for nominated films.
Did you manage to watch all of them? Are you still doing that?
I did, and it's so much easier now.
There's only five.
So Henry V, I mean, obviously Laurence Olivier doing Shakespeare, it's going to be good, but it's, I don't know, it's not anything to write home about. It looks very, very much just like a filmed theatrical presentation. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine. The Razor's Edge is another war picture about the horrors of war, and, you know, you've kind of seen it before. It's fine. And then your favorite movie, The Yearling, that I know you're really anxious.
Jane Wyman murders a deer.
Oh, God. It's rough. I don't know, man. I think a little bit it's ruined because I know how that movie ends. Like, it's like people now watching Old Yeller, like, you know, this is going to be fucking sad. So it kind of, I think it takes away a little bit of that sadness because you kind of know where it's coming. But it is just, I don't know, it's a weird movie, man. Like, you have a pet deer? Really? That's what, all right, I guess.
It's American, Dave.
I guess.
Literally, before we were recording, was watching videos of people having bobcats in their houses. So, you know, a deer, small game.
Yeah, I guess.
Quite literally. Yeah,
absolutely. And then, you know, obviously, like, I've made very clear, and we'll talk about in a future episode, how I feel about It's a Wonderful Life. Like, I think it's one of
terrible film.
Probably it's one of the 25 best movies ever made. Like, I think it's truly, truly incredible, which is why I was so ready to hate this movie. I thought I was going to have the, like, what Citizen Kane fans feel about how green was my valley. Like, just like, ah, oh, fuck this movie. It's the one that took it away. But I'm not mad at this. I'm not mad at this at all. I think it's actually a very, very good movie. I think it's. I mean, I haven't, like, redone my rankings of the movies that we watched at One Best Picture so far, but it's certainly up there.
I think so too.
High quality movie.
Yeah, yeah. I think to me, this is what a Best Picture winner should be. In a lot of ways, it should be something that is so well considered that is. William Wyler is one of the great directors. There's no denying that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, as much as we may dig on Mrs. Miniver, you know, this is a guy who has done some really great films. But The Best Years of Our Lives, as I was saying, like, in that episode, I hadn't seen this film yet. And then watching Mrs. Miniver, I thought, oh, I get the feeling that that is what he's... The stuff that is in The Best Years of Our Lives is certainly stuff that he... was trying to explore during wartime with Mrs. Miniver, but couldn't do it because the war was raging. And here, he's able to actually, he's got the space to actually look at what's going on and to look at it in a reflective manner that is very empathetic and very caring and very progressive for a time that is, you know, maybe not as progressive as it seems in the history books. And granted, they keep, you know, America keeps on taking away the history books, so it's hard to keep track of these things. But it's a bit, you know, my point of view is watching a lot of 1950s films, and granted, this came out in 1946, so it's leading into the 1950s. But
sure,
the 1950s films look back at the 1940s post-war in a way that is kind of like, don't worry about it. It's fine.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's not a problem. Whereas this is very much like, hey, people, we have problems. We need to address them, and we need to address them now. And again, like, I was very surprised to see a conspiracy theorist character in this film.
Like, dude, I couldn't believe that sequence. Like, I was just like, what? I had a lot of this feeling when I was watching this movie. Like, what year is it?
Yeah.
What year was this movie made? Like, this feels like, granted, not in acting style or anything like that, but this feels like a movie looking back many years later, like maybe a movie from like the 60s or 70s, looking back at this time, because it's so forward thinking. And that scene specifically, like, because you kind of, as you start, as someone like me, who's pretty liberal and read liberal is pretty anti-war.
Yep.
You listen to that character and you're like, well, you know, maybe. But then, like, as he goes into more detail about what he's talking about, you're like, oh, okay, this guy's a crackpot, and this guy's being really insulting to people who literally, in this case, lost their limbs. And you very much are on Homer's side in that. And I think it's the one moment in the movie where you really, truly feel that frustration, where he feels like, oh, God, if I only had my hands, like, God, what I would do to this man.
Yeah.
You know, and you feel that anger and you feel that rage and that kind of impotent rage almost. in that moment. And then you realize like how important it is to have your brothers in arms.
Yeah.
How important it is to have your friends to back you up. And that's not anything to do with disability. There's moments in all of our lives where we feel useless and we feel like we can't make a difference, even though we know what the right thing to do is. And that's when we need to lean on our friends.
Mm.
And you really do feel that. And it's interesting. You brought it up that like, they didn't know each other before the beginning of this movie, before the beginning of this couple weeks.
Yeah.
But it's almost like you see the way they interact and you're like, this is camaraderie. This is brotherhood. This is love. And you feel it from all of them. And even when they're at odds, as I mentioned before, there's not rage at each other. It's almost like that parental almost disappointment.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe you're here. I don't want to have this conversation with you, but I have to protect my daughter, right? Not from you, but from the situation that you're bringing. I don't think you ever feel like he shows up and he's shaking his finger at him and saying he's a bad person. It's just like, man, you can't do this. You can't do this to yourself. You can't do this.
And
you've
got to do the right thing. Because they look at, like, you know, Myrna Loy and Friedrich March, they're a great pair there. And especially you get to see, as you were talking about the Nick and Nora thing before, it's perfect casting with having Myrna Loy there because of the expectation of the characters that she has played over those films, the Thin Man films, and, of course, extensively throughout her career, that lighter character. She's given something that's a little bit darker and deeper here because she's missed her husband throughout the time that he's been off at war.
Right.
But there is that understanding and compassion for him. There is an understanding and compassion for his situation. And that mm-hmm. is missing from Fred's partner. It's missing from that situation. And they both have an understanding of what a perfect marriage should be, or maybe not a perfect marriage, but a marriage that is very much like, you know, as they say, no, we fight all the time. You know,
right.
We love each other, but we have our ups and downs. And they're trying to explain this to Peggy as a way of being like, yeah, by the way, look, you think that you might be able to break up his marriage, but they might just be going through a fight or a phase
right.
at this point. And they're trying to reason with her and come to reason and don't actually get to see the, you know, that there is no love there. There is no bond
right.
whatsoever at all. There never was. And she obviously has been living it up on his army dollars while he's been off at war. But mm-hmm. coming back to that core relationship with the three guys, I think there is a beautiful moment as well that is very much in support of Homer, where the three guys are sitting down and they're having a drink at the bar that they go to, Butcher's Bar, and they meet some new people, and you can tell that the new people have this look on their face, like looking at Homer, he's got hooks. And then Al goes, all right, we're going to address one thing right away. Yes, Homer has hooks. Two, it doesn't mean anything. We're not going to make a big deal about it. And in that
right.
moment, it's just like, yeah, okay, we've addressed it. You're looking at them. It doesn't mean
right.
anything. Move on. And
right.
I love that kind of thing because especially coming in 1946, where, you know, this film made a lot of money. It was had a budget of $2.1 million and it made a box office of $23.7 million. And so a lot
Jeez.
Of people went to go and see it. And so having
yeah.
something like that in their cultural mind, in their mind to go, okay, sure, this person might be losing a leg. It might be losing an arm or something like that. I'm not going to make a big deal about it. And, you know, it's those kinds of things that have an impact on our day-to-day life. I just think that there is so much about this film that I think is really quite powerful and quite impressive that they managed to turn something around so reflectively about the war in such a short period of time. And granted, I mean,
yeah.
we say that like it's a surprise, you know, oh, I can't believe that they managed to do this in a short period of time. But it's like, films take a long time to make, but on the same hand, people are very quick-witted. You know, they are
mm-hmm.
alert and they know what's going on. They're smart. We're not stupid people. And so already, you know, we're doing things about COVID that happen, you know, straight away.
Sure.
Well, look at the Trump
era. But are they any good?
Well, don't look up, Dave. Don't look up, you know.
yeah.
But it's just nice to see that there are films that can comment on the immediacy of, well, the present straight away
mm-hmm.
in a way that
yeah.
says, you know, it's going to be okay if we do these things. It's interesting as well, one of the things which I found quite fascinating about this film is it is very anti-capitalist in some manners. And that's most pointed in the sequences where they're talking about giving loans to soldiers who don't have any capital, who don't have any, you know, collateral or anything like that to be able to put the loan, put up against the loan. And Al is employed to be able to give these people loans and then is told swiftly, you know, it's okay to do this one, but we can't do it for every single one. And his response is, you know, a bit drunken, but his response is, look, we've got to look after these people because they are the future. They are, they are our country. It is who we are as people. And if we don't do this, then what does that make us? And, you know, obviously time shows that if we didn't look after them, we didn't look after many of the soldiers, and we didn't look after the economy and supporting people in being able to get started and have a good life, because look at America, look at Australia, look at the UK. It's all around us, and it's happening right now with COVID. But I found that really surprising. Like, I don't think that William Wyle's a really left-leaning director or anything like that, but I just found it surprising to see that in there. Were you surprised by that at all?
Yeah, and I was also surprised by, there's a sequence with Fred later where he like kind of climbs into the cockpit of this old bomber. And they very pointedly say, like, basically they're turning this into scrap. They're turning it to junk. And I think that's an indictment of the country as a whole in how, because it's talking in the movie, it's talking about the implements of war. But what it's really talking about is our soldiers. Like, this is, now we're just turning this into a different type of scrap and a different type of money and a different way to implement this. And it is like, whew, it is rough. And it's another one of my favorite shots in the film is when he first climbs back in and you see him kind of looking out at the, at what he's become, you know, and what has become of what he used to do, you know, he's lost. And it made me think as I was watching this, because this actor, Dana Andrews, was also in a movie we covered earlier, The Oxbow Incident. And it's like, he might be, like, in my mind, like, one of the most underrated leading men of this era. Like, he's so good. And he tends to be, at least in the movies that we've watched for this podcast, he's been a little bit overshadowed by other actors in these movies that also happen to be great, like Fonda in The Oxbow Incident. And the young man who plays Homer in this, like, he's definitely the one we remember from this, but like, he's such a wonderful leading man, steadying force in both of these movies. Like, he's so good. And like, you know, that scene I talked about earlier at the wedding when he's the best man, like, so much of it is his look and the way he looks at her. And it just communicates so much. And he's one of those actors I'm kind of curious to go back and watch more movies that he's been in, because every movie that I've seen with him in it so far has been just tremendous.
He's very captivating. He's really quite
also very good looking, like, let's be honest. He's also very pleasant to look at. Like,
yeah, I find it interesting as well, like, just having a look at the poster, he's on the poster, Friedrich Marx, Myrna Loyd, Teresa Wright, and then Virginia Mayo, who plays Fred's wife, it's on the poster. And poor Harold Russell.
The loose woman.
Yeah, poor Harold Russell isn't on the poster. Doesn't even get a mention. So, you know, very much a supporting character there. But, yeah, I feel like I've seen this film on a lot of best-of lists. It was in 1989. It was selected as one of the first 25 films selected to be part of the Library of Congress for Preservation of the National Film Society. So it is a majorly culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant film. So it seems a bit redundant to be surprised that it is good. But I guess, you know, when...
Look, there's a lot of movies that a lot of people think are great that I watch and I'm like, wah, wah. Like, people love Mrs. Miniver. I think it's bad. I don't think it's an enjoyable movie. I don't like the lessons it's teaching. I don't really like the filmmaking. So, like, you never know. There are movies every year. You know, we talk a lot about Oscar winners and, like, there are movies. I mean, you know, Green Book won an Oscar. You know, like, it's not any good. So you never know. And we never know 10 years later what we're going to look back on and think like, oh, that's actually a really important movie.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes I think we know right away, like when you see a movie like Moonlight, you know, like, okay, there's something important happening here. But do you know that every time? Not necessarily. So like, there are lots of movies that are really well thought of that I go back and I'm like, really, that one?
Yeah.
That's and I mean, you have that reaction to Citizen Kane.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Like, so you just never know what you're gonna like and what's gonna pull you in.
And we've said that about some of the films that were nominated in the past. We've discussed that at the time they weren't well received, but they were nominated, and you know, have gone on to be enduring classics. Grand Illusion, for example.
Right.
You know, those kinds of things.
And sometimes the opposite, right? Like, if you ask, I have learned the painful lesson that if you talk to people who really like Hitchcock and bring up Suspicion, they're like, nah, that movie sucks. That's not any good. But it got nominated for Best Picture. Like, it's, you know, you just never know.
Yep. And so did Spellbound. And, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet Vertigo and Shadow of a Doubt and Psycho didn't. It's just, it's a roll of the dice, really. It kind of is.
It really is.
Do you have anything more to say about the best years of our lives? Is there anything?
I would just say that if you haven't seen this movie and the runtime is getting you down, to just give it a shot. Because I think you'll know within like the first 30 minutes whether this movie is for you or not. And it's, I don't know, it's better than its description. Because if you look at the script, like, oh, three men come home from war and they have trouble getting back into normal life. Like, oh, God, I've seen this before. Who cares? But it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you're someone who pretends like you care about representation and how people are shown on screen that usually aren't, this is a must-see.
Exactly.
You know, this is, I mean, I feel like, sadly, this movie handles differing abilities physically better than a lot of movies do now.
Oh, very much so.
I was really impressed. And I was so, Andrew, I was so worried, like, when this character shows up with no fore, I was like, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, it's 1946, oh, no, this is going to be so bad. And it's like, wow, they're handling this really respectfully.
Yeah.
And it shocked me. I just kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. I just kept waiting for there to be a scene and be like, isn't it terrible? He should kill himself, blah, blah, blah. And there's none of that. Especially none of that from characters that we know we should be listening to. The only people who say terrible things to him are like the conspiracy nuts. Like, okay, well, we don't have to listen to the fool on the bar stool. We need to listen to our lead characters.
Yeah.
And they all build him up, and not in a way that feels false. It never feels like infantilizing at any point. And I was so, so impressed by that, because we still don't know how to do that in film now. And the fact that we did it in the late 40s is pretty impressive.
Exactly. Yeah, give your Oscar back, Eddie Redmayne. But I think that, you know, like, there are just moments here. There's a moment early on where Harold Russell is in a scene with his on-screen father, and his father is taking off his prosthetics. And we don't see his arms at that point. We just see that he's taking them off. And at that point, I was like, oh, are we going to save it for some kind of reveal later on? And they are really revealed in a very emotional scene, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, later on. Gentle scene.
Yeah, which is very kind and considerate. And I thought that was just very, kind, considerate, and a very powerful film in a lot of ways. I think this is really, really good. It's great. And it is a surprising film because of the things that it does. Because, as you're saying, we haven't done those things in modern films. Mm-hmm. We haven't done those things in so long. And, you know, this is 1946. Like, 60 years later, how can we have not fixed these problems in cinema still?
Right. Or at least just done this. Just lived up to this example, but no. We're bad.
Yeah, we've got to get Jake Gyllenhaal and get him to have, you know, whatever that film was. Stronger, was it? Yeah.
Stronger, yes, that is the name of that bad movie. Yes.
Like, why? Why?
Yeah.
You know, it's not hard to get people who are
disabled actors.
Have them on screen. Yeah.
We did it in 1946.
Yep. Exactly. So, does this film matter? I think we kind of answered the question.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. I think just from a representation standpoint in a movie like this, it matters. And also just showing, without over-dramatizing things, showing the difficulty of coming back from war and how little we as a culture and a society do for these folks who, whether you agree with the war or not, is really not the point. Mm. The point is these men and women offered up their life and limbs for freedom, for the right reasons. Whether the country was doing it for the right reasons is a different conversation.
Yeah.
But these men did it for the right reasons, and we still treated them like literal little junk, as we mentioned in that scene, in a junkyard. So it's important to take a closer look at the part that we all play.
Agreed.
So yeah, it definitely matters.
Definitely. I agree with that completely. It is a film that matters, and it is very important, and it's good. And it's not just because of Teresa Wright this time. It's good, you know.
Not just.
Unfortunately, this will be the last time that we'll be talking about her in this podcast. But if you haven't gathered, you should really go and watch Shadow of a Doubt. She's great in that. You could also watch The Rainmaker. That was her last film from 1997.
Jeez. Nothing in between. Just Shadow of a Doubt and The Rainmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Do that. And then also watch this. You can follow us on social media, I guess, if you want to do that, because I tweet so often there. But awards don't pod.
Basically, anytime I tag.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, no, shit.
It might be. Oh, yeah, I have a Twitter account.
That's right. Cool. Where can people find you, Dave?
You can find me at Darn That Dave on Twitter. I also write and edit for In Session Film. I have a bunch of other podcasts, but you can find them all at Darn That Dave. But really, you should follow Awards Don't Pod. We'll be more active, we swear.
Sure, yeah. Especially because the Oscar nominations are tomorrow. So, you know.
Yeah, it's time.
We will have thoughts. All right, we'll see you all on the next episode, which is for some film by Frank Capra.
A wonderful film, one might say.
Yeah. Christmassy, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, we're a little light. Who cares?
Doesn't matter.
This is a movie for all seasons, Andrew. We're going to watch It's a Wonderful Life.
Exactly. Cool. We'll see you on the next one.
Hey, you guys, jump. Get out of there. Bail out. Gdansky, get out of that plane.
Two shoots open. Three.
Come on, the rest of you guys.
Fred.
Come on, get out.
Fred, wake up.
Gdansky.
Wake up.
Gdansky.
Wake up.
She's burning up. Get out.
Fred.
Get out.
Fred, wake up. Wake up.
She's burning up. She's going to hit the gun.
It's all right, Fred. Go back to sleep. Go back to sleep. Go back to sleep, Fred. There's nothing to be afraid of. All you have to do is go to sleep. Rest.